Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com.
We're very lucky right now to be joined by Eric Fine, Portfolio Manager in Emerging Markets Fixed Income Strategy at Van Eck Global. He just returned from IMF meetings in Bali. He got back Sunday night. He's been going to these meetings for 20 years. This one was different for you. How so?
First, what's different is they're crowded. And there are a lot of people, and it speaks to the amount of investment that's gone into EM and EM bonds, and that's a good thing. I think the biggest thing is this is one of the most, if not the most, worried meetings, in the sense of, I go to the meetings and then I spend time with the old timers afterwards and see, are you leaving here as more of a seller or more of a buyer? Because you have to have a bottom line on everything, obviously, and a seller, but much more concern about China. That's really the thing. China set up as though you could have said a lot of the things that are being said now a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago. And I think that's fair. The issue is, when is it relevant? Why does it matter? And that's why I care. Is it now? For reasons I can get into, but now it's elevated as a concern.
Well, that's where I wanted to go. Is this a matter of China's economy accelerating its slowdown, or does this have to do with trade tensions with the U.S.?
I think you can't disentangle the issues, even though it's trade is a big jobs generator in China, and the current account surplus is declining, and that's an important. Important generator of jobs, but it's important generator of confidence. Why do I say that? The setup for China, I think China's a country that has for 20 years been disciplined by equity investors. What do equity investors want? Growth. Growth, 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 growth. Bond investors are very different. They're happy with recessions. They welcome recessions. They worry about overleverage, right? So they've gotten the growth, but with the growth came immense leverage. So the setup, the initial conditions are bad. They're not bad in the traditional sense of, oh my gosh, they owe a lot of dollars and they don't have them. It's a very different setup, and that's why people have been calm, and that's also essentially why I think the market's been right to sort of say, it's not really, it's a problem, but not really a problem for today and not something I care about. The issue there is domestic claims. The most acute phase of EM crises in my experience is when locals lose confidence and all the money, M0, the money in your pocket, M1, a short-term claim like a demand deposit, or M2, something like include savings accounts, when people start closing that and saying, I want the dollars, I want the reserves. And that ratio in China is basically the worst in the world. The amount of domestic claims on dollars. And you know what you're getting for a 10-year bond in China in the local currency? 3.5% in a 10-year. Do I need to say anything else? Right? That's the issue. And, if the arguments go, they can hike interest rates. Hike interest rates, what is that going to do to growth? Right? And if the growth gets hit, this is an economy that depends on significant investment. Almost half of GDP is investment. So those, I think, are the issues that are coming to the fore, but they're coming. The trigger is, as you're suggesting, is trade. But this broadening of this tense of the relationship with China, or the tense points on to beyond trade, I think is settling in people's minds, and it's a new big risk.
When you talk about a new big risk, there's a headline in the South China Morning Post several weeks ago, $6 trillion debt bubble, which Chinese local authorities have built up. Go ahead.
How
do you unwind that without a lot of pain?
Yeah. Look, I today's announcement is more sort of new products, right? More leverage. And I was struck by how more leverage and stimulation my sense is that it's viewed as a legitimate policy option. More stimulation, stimulating, and then having your currency weaken is not stimulating, right? That's spinning your wheels, right, and trying to get out of something. Every time we've looked at the Chinese financial system, and we feel like we get a handle on it, some new balance sheet with leverage comes up, and so that's a real problem. The one thing that we've consistently said, though, and that is probably still the case, is the Chinese authorities are extremely impressive.
Right.
When you bring up these problems, if you brought up that problem, they are not denying it. That's the other thing that characterizes every crisis. They know these. They have tools to deal. They come up with tools to deal with it. It's just that the what they need to do might be bigger than what they've thought. So, you know, you got to give them the benefit of the doubt. But these issues are come up and they're real. And so far, the government's had the credibility to say, look, don't worry about it. We're doing something.
So I want to go back to those IMF meetings that you had with the old timers, as you said. How much are they considering that a possible disruption in China, how much of an impact would that have on the rest of the emerging markets complex, and which countries would get hit the hardest and are they staying away from as a result of this uncertainty?
Short answer, profound impact and all. Right.
Really?
Now, yeah, but I don't think that means run for the hills. Right. Argentina's already been through a lot. Right. You can find short dated bonds with high yields where, right or wrong in the world, if they mature and they pay their carry, you're going to be fine. So
by
this
the
is
way,
not a
kudos to you, because when you came in here, you basically called the bottom of the Argentinian bond sell off. So carry
Thank
on.
Well, thanks. No. So but there are a lot of countries that are being stressed out by tougher financial conditions and the trade conflict. So one straightforward answer is there's some cheap things to do in emerging markets. And those are them. But China's been opening for 40 years. For the last 40, maybe 30 plus years, you've had declining inflation and inflation expectations and rising trade. They've been related. Right. I mean, it's, you know, the economic logic of globalization, optimizing global outcomes and reducing inflation and is correct. Doesn't mean it's right, but it's certainly correct. I think that's at risk, this 30-year trend.
Thanks very much for being with us. And we look forward to having you in the future. Eric Fine, lots to talk about. Portfolio manager, emerging markets, fixed income strategy for VanEck Global.
For much of this week, the news in Washington, D.C. was dominated by Saudi Arabia and U.S. relations and what would happen now that there was a disappearance that resulted in the most likely death of a journalist who worked for The Washington Post. But is that the big takeaway from this week? Marty Shanker joins us now, Chief Content Officer for Bloomberg News. Definitely, the news out of Washington, D.C. is moving so quickly that you blink, you miss it. How much lasting power will the Saudi Arabia-U.S. story have going forward, or will people just sort of forget about this? Does it have legs?
It definitely does have legs, and it continues even today. There's somewhat of a lull. It's the Sabbath in the region in the Mideast, so there isn't a lot of news. But in the issue as it relates to Donald Trump's response is still very top of mind in the politics of Washington. Whether or not it actually resonates into the midterm elections is another question.
Why?
Because I think that midterm...
Why is it resonating so strongly politically?
Because it, in some ways, and I think the news channels reflect this, it speaks to Donald Trump's unconventional way of conducting foreign policy and the transactional nature of his presidency. You know, immediately people have gone to the whole issue of what kind of business relationship does Donald Trump have? Why isn't there a sense of complete outrage? Why aren't we taking very concrete steps to sever our close relationship with Saudi Arabia? And in Donald Trump's defense, it is a very complicated issue. And many people have commented on the fact that Khashoggi's death, while tragic, hundreds of thousands of people being killed in Yemen, and no one says a word about that.
Indeed. And just to kind of add a little bit more to the story, there was a report that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo initially did hear the audio that the Turkish government claims right. they have, mm-hmm. when in fact a State Department spokeswoman came out yesterday and said no, had neither heard the audio nor the transcript. So my question then is, what do you think Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was doing in Saudi Arabia? And is there a potential for conversations about succession planning in Saudi Arabia?
Well, I can't speculate about what Mike Pompeo is thinking, but clearly all the participants in this controversy are trying to figure a way out. That includes Donald Trump. That includes this the Saudi government, in a way that provides some accountability for what happened in the Saudi embassy in Ankara, while still having repercussions. And Donald Trump did hint at that, that there would be severe consequences if it was determined that there was a murder in some way connected to the Saudi government. But it is true that the Saudis are critically important to the strategic interests of the United States. And you have to balance that against, you know, this obviously outrageous action. And they're all trying to figure a way out.
So let's talk about the political fallout. There definitely has been vocal criticism from fellow Republicans in the Senate and elsewhere. There are reports that Nikki Haley may have resigned from the UN post as a result of this. Is there any truth to that?
Well, we're, you know, that is the big question. No one, as far as I can tell, has definitively said why Nikki Haley decided to resign and why she decided to resign now. None other than Steve Bannon, who is not should not be underestimated in terms of his political acumen, said that this was a horrible thing to do.
Terrible timing,
yeah. You know, like less than a month before midterms. She was at the Al Smith dinner last night and actually joked a little bit about it. But it could have been a factor, but then there are, you know, multiple things that could also, there was also a report that it was Kavanaugh, which she denied. Anyway, she has her reasons, and maybe ultimately we'll find them out.
So let's shift gears a little bit, because we are heading into the midterm elections, and I'm just wondering how important it is to sort of watch what comes out of President Trump's Twitter feed to figure out his agenda over the next couple of months or next couple of weeks ahead of the midterm elections, right? I mean, we've already got a lot of discussion about immigration and the, right. and the march. What should we pay attention to here?
Well, I think if you looked at his, if you listened to his rally speech last night, he sort of outlined what his strategy is for the midterms. It's, you know, that the economy is great. We're going for safe borders. I think he used the slogan that the Democrats are mobs and the Republicans are about jobs. And that's a pretty effective argument. Whether it, and there is polling that shows that, you know, there is a narrowing of this race, that the blue tide is actually could be questioned, and that the poll numbers are moving in the GOP's direction. So that kind of messaging may be quite effective as we run down to the final days of this midterm campaign.
Just a little bit more on Saudi Arabia, Marty.
Yeah.
Is it a situation where business interests are colliding with strategic interests?
I would say that they're similar. They're
okay.
Aligned. And we and others have written stories. While the headline people like Jamie Dimon about out of the investor conference next week, a lot of the underlings are going to be in the region and attending that conference, because there is such financial importance to the Saudi Arabia wealth that no one can afford to kind of ostracize. So there are deep historical financial connections that will underpin that relationship, just as there are deep political strategic relationships on the government side that will continue that relationship.
Thanks very much for being with us. Always a pleasure. Marty Shenker, he is our chief content officer here at Bloomberg News. Much appreciated talking about Saudi Arabia and U.S. relations in light of the disappearance and alleged murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a contributing journalist to the Washington Post. It is time to talk about Brazil and Brazil's largest airline group. Well, in English, it's called Gol Intelligent Airlines. It carries more than 33 million passengers each year on more than 700 daily flights, more than 60 destinations. The chief financial officer is Richard Lark, and he joins us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studios. Richard Lark, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
Start by just describing for people that may not be familiar with your airline how it came to be and how it has come to really be the premier airline in Brazil.
Yeah, we started in 2001, which is about 1 year after we had deregulation in Brazil. And we started with a traditional low-cost carrier based on a single fleet type, which for us was the Boeing 737. High operating efficiency, high utilization. And we started with four aircraft in 2001, and a combination of the cost advantage of the company plus the fare dynamic allowed us to, over a 10-year period, become the largest airline in Brazil. That was also helped by two acquisitions that we did. And over the last couple of years, we've been investing heavily in our product, technology, and the onboard customer experience, which has allowed us today to become the number one business airline in Brazil.
All right, so let's fast forward to now. We have a situation where the Brazilian economy has been mired in a deep recession, the worst in its history. Things are starting to look up a little bit, at least when you look at bond and stock markets, possibly because of the candidate Bolsonaro that looks like the front runner, who has a much more conservative view toward cutting the deficit and rearranging some of the pensions. I'm just wondering, from your perspective, how much will this give a boost to your company, should this go through and there is some measure of reform that gets enacted on the governmental level?
Yeah, obviously we can't predict the outcome of the elections, but assuming we see that, we'll adjust to the outcome. We see a lot of components in Bolsonaro's platform are very clear in terms of the impact that they're going to have on our sector, such as in addition to the reforms you mentioned, pension, tax reform, we're also in his platform seeing some things that will be positive for the airline sector, such as increasing airport privatizations. We have a dire need for improvement in infrastructure in airports and airspace in Brazil, and a general liberalization of a lot of the other regulations that affect our sector, such as bilateral agreements on international travel, foreign capital rules. We also think that the policies are going to have a positive impact on demand, particularly in the corporate space, and within that, particularly the agro sector in Brazil, which is a big portion of our air travel base also.
Just to get specific on GOL for a moment, ratings upgrade when it comes to your credit, tender offers, redemptions, improved cash liquidity, this is all giving you greater financial flexibility. Any idea what you're going to do with the money?
Well, in the short term, we're continuing deleveraging. Over the next 2 years, we expect to delever by another 2 billion reais, which is, call it $500-600 million. And that's the main focus of this additional cash flow we're generating in the short term is continued deleveraging. We were upgraded back to a single B, but our target is to get back to a double B minus entity within the next 2 years.
I'm curious about the mix of your travelers. How much is domestic versus international, and how has that shifted?
Yeah, today we're about 85% domestic, 15% international. We have been globalizing our business constantly over the years, pretty much since our founding. Today we have over 90 co-chairs and interlines. We sell tickets in over 140 countries around the world. And in fact, one of the reasons why we're up in New York today is we're talking about our direct service that we're adding to Miami and Orlando. In 2 weeks, we launch service.
Yeah.
And that's going to allow us to expand our non-Brazilian O&Ds, non-Brazilian revenues from the current 15 to around 25% over the next 3 to 5 years.
So how does the backdrop of increased trade tensions and tariffs, et cetera, affect your business, if at all, especially as you try to globalize?
Well, we have a platform that has been developed over a period of time based on a lot of global partnerships. We have a very strong relationship with Delta Airlines, with Air France, KLM. And what really drives these flows is the demand on the Brazilian side of the equation. For example, you take what we're adding service to South Florida. Part of it is leisure, but there's a very large small business component in South Florida. A lot of Brazilians have small businesses there. And we don't see that very much affected by anything on the trade side. Obviously, it is affected by on the currency side, which affects purchasing power, which affects our business, but we're expecting improvements on that.
Well, that's where I was going to go, was with the idea that if you have a devaluing currency, that makes it just that much more challenging to buy the 120 Boeing 737 MAX aircraft. Tell us about why you decided on the 737 MAX and how that's going to change the operating efficiency of the company.
Yeah, the main reason is the fuel economy. The 737 MAX 8, which is the model we're operating, we already have three operating in the fleet, is already achieving for us a 15% fuel economy. And about a third of our costs are our jet fuel. So that has a significant impact on our margins. So that's been the main driver to have that absolute cost reduction. Secondarily, you know, Brazil is a very dynamic, competitive market, and our competitors are also investing in improved aircraft on the Airbus side of the equation. We're the only Boeing operator in Brazil. But the second reason is the larger, slightly larger configuration of the MAX will be configured with 186 seats as opposed to our current 177. That gives us greater revenue productivity. But the final reason, which is important, which is facilitating these flights that we're launching in 2 weeks to Miami and Orlando, is the additional range of about 1,500 kilometers on the MAX that allows us to do direct flights to Miami and Orlando.
Richard Lark, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Richard Lark is Chief Financial Officer of Gol Airlines, based in Sao Paulo, Brazil, but joining us here in our 1130 studios. Among all stocks, Procter & Gamble really stands out, posting a gain today that is the biggest since October 2008, more than 8% climb. Well, they beat earnings. They posted great expectations. Joining us now to talk about this, Sarah Halzack, Bloomberg Opinion consumer columnist. Sarah, come on in here. Is this just that we like to buy really expensive creams and we just keep on buying them and Procter & Gamble cashed in on that?
So that's certainly a part of it. Beauty was a particularly strong division with 7% organic sales growth in the quarter, and they definitely have been having success with their premium lines within beauty. So SK-II, which has very high price tags, has been leading the growth in that division for some time now. But that said, that's not the whole picture. They really had strength in their, they grew sales in their grooming division, their healthcare division, their fabric division. So a broad-based series of categories fueling this gain this quarter.
Sarah, this has to do also with organic sales growth, correct?
It does. So organic sales growth, what they mean with that number is sort of excluding M&A activity and currency fluctuations. And so that's a closely watched metric for this particular company, given its global reach. But if you're talking about organics, that is definitely an area that they're focused on, and naturals, understanding that the consumer is kind of moving in this direction and considering that more of a priority. So, for example, in the diapers division, they now have this Pampers Natural lines that's supposed to be made in a more sustainable way. And that helped drive growth in the quarter.
I love this sort of organic growth versus organics. And then I have to wonder, what is organic face cream? I mean, how is that organic? It boggles my mind. I do want to ask you, though, Sarah, they also said that they were gaining market share in a number of different divisions. Who's the loser here? Who are they grabbing market share from?
Yeah, it's not. I think it varies widely across the globe. So, for example, I think one interesting place to look is in their Love's diaper division. That's a place where they had been getting smacked by the private label diapers makers because they had so underpriced. So you can assume that's from the likes of Walmart, from Target, from Amazon, who have strong private label offerings there. They slashed prices in the Love's division this quarter to try to get some of that market share back. And so presumably that's sort of where that push and pull is taking place.
Have they been able to raise prices, or is that still a challenge?
That's a really good question. So they have announced they're going to be raising prices on some key brands like Bounty, Charmin, and Puffs because of commodity costs, right? Pulp costs, paper costs are increasing. And so they're going to be taking those price increases starting October 31st. We don't know yet how consumers are going to respond to that. And I think that's a really important thing when you look at how sustainable is this growth that they deliver this quarter. That's a real X factor. Executives were cautioning on the conference call today that trying to take these price increases could result in some volatility because they don't know how much a Kimberly-Clark or a Colgate-Palmolive is going to move in the same direction, and they could end up losing shoppers when they take that action.
I'm the strange person that actually pays attention to the price of my toilet paper or my paper towels. Do you, Pim?
No.
Do you, Sarah? I pay attention to that. I mean, the differential can be dollars, like entire dollars in one package.
I don't. I'm definitely a person who's just on autopilot. You know,
oh,
I have
no.
my brand loyalty.
I'm revealing too much about myself. Well, I want to get your sense on how much Procter & Gamble is just doing things right itself and how much it's indicative of the strong consumer that people have really been rejecting so far this year. I mean, Procter & Gamble shares are still down nearly 2% year to date. So, you know, is the consumer a lot stronger than people think? And does this give wind to other consumer product companies?
I do think this is an indicator of the fact that the consumer environment is strong, and we see this in so many different ways. We saw this in strong quarters from major retailers in Q2, and I think this is an additional reflection of that. That said, I do think that the consumer's been strong for a while now, right? So the fact that P&G is seeing this inflection point does speak to some of the things they're doing right. I think particularly in the grooming category, that is a business where they were just assaulted by these newcomers like Dollar Shave Club and Harry's that were offering these sort of disruptive subscription models, and they finally returned to growth there this quarter. And so that suggests that, you know, they, on the one hand, did some smart things in terms of adjusting their price structure to be more competitive with those guys, and also just got their mix of products in the right places in front of the right shoppers.
I got to imagine, though, that whatever happens in China is also important to Procter & Gamble. They cited double-digit growth in some of their skincare lines in China.
Yes, and China is a very – so China's very important to their future. Right now, it's actually only 9% of their total annual sales, but certainly that will change over time as the middle class grows there. But China is definitely a real success story for P&G. It was only 2 years ago that they were posting declining sales in that market overall, and they've just been doing a lot of consumer product 101-type work there. I think the Olay brand is a great example of that. So in China, they really wanted to make that brand stronger, so they changed the packaging of their Olay face product. That's a place where in the Chinese market, you might have actual like over-the-counter service with a customer representative there. So they sort of changed the training and the approach to that kind of service.
Notice,
and it's really worked.
Notice, Pim, she doesn't say change the cream. It's change the packaging, change the way people talk
about
it.
Well, that's where most
change,
of the marketing is the one that grabs so most
gullible.
Of the money.
We're so gullible. It's true. When something is more expensive and packaged in a prettier package, I can be a sucker.
Those gross
too.
Margins, they could be over 90%. Thanks very much. Sarah Halzack, an expert in all things retail, our Bloomberg Opinion consumer columnist, telling us about Procter & Gamble.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.